Hello and welcome back to Sequelize It, where we tackle the triumphs and dissect the disasters of Hollywood, one movie franchise at a time. We are in the thick of our second season and the Indiana Jones film franchise this week as we take a look at Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Spoiler warning, it was not as good as Raiders of the Lost Ark. Frantically searching Wikipedia to see where the Hinduism in this movie ends and the white people tomfoolery begins, I'm KC, and joining me on the podcast is...
I'm your foxy friend Backlash, and prepare to meet Kali in hell!
Oh, God.
I'm no Chris Eleven, and I've betrayed every form of God imaginable.
We are back at it again this week, getting a look at the second collab between George Lucas and Steven Spielberg with a movie that's a lot like Jay-Z and Linkin Park's Collision Course collaboration. It was probably cool at the time, but it's a bit fucking cringe now. But first, the shameless plugs. If you want to help the podcast grow, take a moment and do us a few favors. One, you can leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcasting app of choice. Two, be sure to subscribe so you can be the first to hear new episodes. Three, follow us on Twitter at SequelizeIt. Four, send us an email and let us know what movie franchises you'd like to see us take on at SequelizeIt@gmail.com. And five, if you like what we're doing, just tell a friend to give us a listen and keep on circulating the pod. Backlash and Chris, considering the amount of trouble we had articulating how good Raiders of the Lost Ark last week was, how does it feel to have watched Temple of Doom and knowing we have a fuck ton more to talk about?
A lot of people warned me going into this, like, oh, this movie, it's really weird and it's really just bizarre and out there. And honestly, guys, you guys just didn't warn me enough. Seriously, what the fuck?
I mean, Chris, you said you were going to say that you would disagree.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really think there's a lot to say about this. I think that there are very clear problems with it compared to the first one. Many of which are centered around the fact that, like, the antagonists in this movie are not made up of Nazis. They're made up of a much more ambiguously targeted kind of origin. Culture that the movie perhaps gets wrong on a lot of fronts.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to watch this movie without thinking about just how wrongly it betrays the Indian culture and Indian people, and we'll get into that, but even in spite of that, it's just a weird movie. Like, it starts off feeling normal, and somewhere in the second act,
it starts feeling normal.
I
beg to differ.
Is that as good a segue as any, or are we going to talk trivia first?
And now, trivia. Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark being a smash hit, it really wasn't a question that there would be a sequel. Part of Lucas's deal with Spielberg was that if Spielberg agreed to direct Raiders, he'd have to direct two more sequels, which Lucas assured Spielberg he had plenty of ideas for. Naturally, once Spielberg accepted the deal, he came to find out that Lucas basically had no ideas. It was a bit easier the second time around coming up with ideas for what would become Temple of Doom and was originally titled Temple of Death. However, two of the movie's set pieces, the river rafting scene and the minecart scene, were lifted directly from the original script for Raiders. Writing the movie this time would be the husband and wife team of William Hike, I think is how you pronounce it, and Gloria Katz, after Raiders screenwriter Lawrence Kasdan turned down the chance to write the sequel. Apparently, Kasdan was not into writing a movie that revolved around child slavery, black magic, and demonic cults, finding the entire premise to be pretty mean-spirited. Though those two names may not ring any bells at first, both had written the film American Graffiti for Lucas, and they were uncredited script doctors on Star Wars A New Hope, and apparently responsible for much of the story revolving around Princess Leia. Hike and Katz would later go on to direct, write, and produce the movie Howard the Duck, which would go down as one of the worst movies of all time. Thank God that's not a franchise.
Yet.
Well,
it's not Marvel. A franchise. Marvel. No.
You can, if it is, you can blame Kevin Feige for bringing it back into.
I will never watch a Marvel movie again if Howard the Duck comes to fruition. I mean it.
Well, he technically already did.
A cameo in Guardians of the Galaxy doesn't count. It doesn't count. Hike also wrote and directed the movie Best Defense, which is perhaps better known as the movie where Eddie Murphy shows up and has no interactions with any of the main characters because Paramount figured they might make some money on a really bad movie if they slapped the name Eddie Murphy on the poster. As an extra bit of trivia, this movie actually wound up losing Stinker's Worst Picture of 1984 to the movie Dune.
Yeah. Don't know how I feel about that. Then again, I don't know how I feel about the movie Dune, so let's not touch that.
New to the cast for this movie is Kate Capshaw. Spielberg originally pitched that Marion would return for the sequel to Raiders, but given that this movie is a prequel to Raiders, it wouldn't have made much sense. And in the same vein as the James Bond movies, Lucas wanted there to be a different indie girl for each movie. Capshaw would later go on to marry Steven Spielberg, and you can actually see their chemistry in the Temple of Doom documentary, which is slightly awkward, seeing as though Spielberg was still married at the time of most of the behind-the-scenes footage. Most expensive divorce settlement with his former wife in history, apparently. I read that on Wikipedia. That was interesting to read. I think they're still friends, though, so that was also nice.
Well, I mean, they probably would be friends if one of them got a shitload of money out of it.
Yeah.
this is a movie podcast, not a gossip podcast.
Spielberg apparently cut a scene from the movie wherein Snakes would have to crawl on Capshaw after the actress legitimately had a panic attack, but he made her promise that she would later have to do the scene with the bugs. In addition, this is our introduction to Jonathan Luke Ki-Hwai Kwan as Short Round.
I want to know the justification for this character, for what they explain in the movie about him.
As a young actor, he was brought into the audition room with his brother and repeatedly gave his brother advice on how to play the character, until the casting director asked that he audition instead. Kwan would go on to play Data in The Goonies and find numerous roles in Taiwan, Japan, and Hong Kong productions. Slight spoilers, my opinion on Short Round is that he's pretty okay. He doesn't bother me.
I don't have problems with the character. It's other things that are implied in the movie that we'll talk about.
Yeah. Harrison Ford, of course, returns to portray Indy once again and was apparently instrumental in the hirings of both Capshaw and Kwan. During production, Ford would herniate a disc in his back, leaving him in excruciating pain, including one day when he woke up and could not move backwards or forwards for around 45 minutes.
That explains so much.
Luckily, Ford was in tremendous shape for the film, seeing as though he had to be shirtless. But he would still have to lie down on a hospital bed that was on set before he could shoot any scenes and in between scenes. It was actually George Lucas's call to shut down production for 6 to 8 weeks to allow Ford to get surgery and get his back into shape. The movie was originally set to be shot in India, but the Indian government had several problems with their script. No fucking clue why. Meaning that eventually the shooting of the movie would be done in Sri Lanka. The movie, once again, had a pretty modest budget of $28.2 million, would go on to make $333.1 million at the box office. It has an 84% on Rotten Tomatoes and an 81% audience score. Somewhat tellingly, however, Spielberg has called Temple of Doom his least favorite of the trilogy, saying that the best thing he got out of it was his wife, Kate Capshaw. And now, our feature presentation.
Okay, so if you were taking bets on how a second Indiana Jones movie would start, if you guessed a Chinese rendition of a Cole Porter song, why? Like, seriously, this is where the movie starts normal? There's like an alternate dimension full of dancers in dragon attire? This is normal to you. Okay, sure. What is the excuse for whatever this is? Well, we find ourselves in Shanghai at Club Obi-Wan. I see what you did there, George, where we find Indiana Jones. Well, I guess this is probably a normal thing for him, exchanging the remains of some ancient thing for a big-ass diamond with a Chinese gangster, Lao Che. Unfortunately, Indy forgets the one rule when dealing with shady individuals. Don't drink anything they give you. Indy briefly gets the upper hand as one of the waiters on his take pulls a gun on Lao Che until... So now the waiter is dying and even gets a dramatic death monologue like he's an actual character. Indy makes one last ditch effort to get to the antidote by holding Lao Che's girl, Willie Scott, at knife point, but Lao Che doesn't really care. One flaming shish kebab to the chest later, and we have an Abbott and Costello routine as Indy chases after the antidote and Willie chases after the diamond. She instead ends up with the antidote as Indy grabs her to make his escape, as Lao Che's goons run into the club when... sorry, hang on. Yeah, hello? Yes, George. It's market research data? Okay. I mean, we could give him a sidekick. What did you have in mind? No, I don't think a rapping dog is going to work, George. Do you have something else? Yeah, okay. What do you mean, bought? Whatever. We'll roll with it. Okay. We're introduced to Short Round, Indy's hired help, as we get a thrilling car chase through the streets of Shanghai. And yes, both Willie and Short Round will be in the rest of the movie. Indy makes his escape to an airport where... Wait, is that fucking Dan Aykroyd? Well, now I know where the idea for the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull came from. Lao Che catches up just in time to see Indy board the plane, but oops, he owns the plane. And instead of doing the smart thing like shooting him in his sleep, the pilots just bail out, leaving Indy and company to crash into a mountain. With no parachutes and only an inflatable river raft, it's time to throw logic out the window as we slide down the mountain neatly into a river where the plot takes us to... I'm sorry, hang on. Yeah. Yeah, George. No, I get that, but isn't this going to come off as kind of offensive? Yeah, I know, we're shooting on location with... Okay, you flew in a bunch of actors? No, okay, we'll go with that. India. We're in India now, eventually finding ourselves in an impoverished Indian village, absolutely amazed at the sight of white people. Indy tries to barter for passage to Delhi, but the village elder struggles to pronounce English words he doesn't understand that basically says Indy will need to go to Pangkot Palace and retrieve a stone that is responsible for making their crops grow and free a bunch of kidnapped children. That night, a starving Indian child appears holding a piece of parchment. The village is all too happy for the return of the child, but Indy's archaeologist senses are tingling at the sight of the parchment, revealing that this stone is one of the lost Shankara stones. The next day, our heroes set out on elephant back. Willie Scott continues to be annoying as we all question why she's here. That night, camp is set up, and Indy explains what the deal with Short Round is. No! And has some sexual tension with Willie. Indy doesn't like snakes. That's act one.
Okay. Nice. That was...
So Lucas has you on speed dial after everything you said about him in the Star Wars reviews.
Kind of because of everything I said about him. Apparently he likes to keep tabs on his critics.
That sounds ominous. So apparently, speaking of Lucas, the opening dance number was apparently George Lucas's idea. You might be shocked. It was essentially Lucas wanted the movie to open with this musical number because reasons. And he was like, oh, come on, Spielberg. You always wanted to direct a musical. And I guess Steven was like, why not?
We can certainly blame Steven Spielberg for going along with a lot of this shit. Like, he is the sort of... I know Rick McCallum fought him a lot, but we'll just stick with the myth rather than the reality and just say that Steven Spielberg was the Rick McCallum of this movie. And, like, relinquished too much control. What I will say is that the opening definitely has, like, a James Bond vibe. We're getting much, much closer to the kind of origins of this franchise or this character. He comes in looking like Sean Connery in Goldfinger with the sort of the white tuxedo and the corsage. And that's not actually a corsage. Is it just a red flower on his... Whatever, I've never been to prom.
Yeah, like, it's not a bad opening. It's just kind of bizarre coming off, like, the last movie. I mean, I'm not asking you to remake the opening of the last movie, but it's really jarring.
I mean, as we'll find out, they kind of do remake the opening of the first one.
Yeah, I mean,
In a weird sense.
Yeah, I mean, it has some of the same beat as the opening of the first movie, but whereas that one showed, like, Indy's knowledge and his daring and his cunning, this one, in a weird way, like, shows us not so much his cunning, but, like, his...
He looks like a fucking chump.
Yeah, he kind of...
Yeah.
And I just realized, wow, this is what one of the climactic moments of Rush Hour 2 got its whole thing from.
Yeah. Is it weird that I think this scene is a little bit too Han Solo? Like, it's a little bit, like, too much, like, Han gets himself into trouble somehow and has to, like, talk his way out of it. Like, if Alden Ehrenreich had to do the scene, I'm pretty sure, like, it would have fit completely in Solo. You would just have to put some more aliens in the shot. It's a weird opening in that it doesn't really establish much. And I didn't realize that this was a prequel to Raiders until I was talking to Chris about it. Like, I had to be like, oh, this happens in 1935. This is what happens the year before Raiders happens. So it doesn't even show us, like, something that we don't already know about Indy. And that'll be like a through line throughout the movie, is that we're not really informed by this movie coming before Raiders of anything about Indy. In fact, it kind of raises more questions, like, where did Willie Scott go and where did Short Round go and why aren't they on the adventure with him in Raiders? Like, it just raises too many questions, and it feels like they could have just made this a sequel and it would have been fine.
Yeah. It's a prequel, but it's one of those prequels that's in the pretty convenient situation of not needing to sort of provide more of an origin for him. But at the same time, it still, like, does things that are refer back to the first one and make you kind of miss it. So,
yeah, like, there's a few cute references, mostly near the end of the movie.
Right.
Yeah, but then when the second you think about it, you're like, wait, that callback doesn't make sense because it hasn't happened yet.
Like, there's no reason this had to be a prequel.
Yeah, absolutely none at all. So when you mentioned that Harrison Ford had a herniated disc, when I said that explains a lot, do you both notice that his voice is so muted in this movie? He barely, like, he's, like, almost above a whisper during dialogue scenes. There's, like, no spirit in what he has to say.
Yeah, now that you mention that, it did kind of throw me off because I was like, why is he acting so different? I think it gets better as the movie goes on, and I'm assuming because as the movie goes on, those scenes were either shot before he got hurt or after he, you know, flew back to Los Angeles and got surgery. I'm assuming.
But I would be 100% not shocked if for a lot of scenes shot he was on painkillers, because he sounds essentially like just table scenes, like scenes where he's just like exchanging just words with people, not necessarily action scenes. But even in those cases, like there are some examples, but he sounds the way he does today.
But in the behind the scenes, Harrison Ford basically says nothing worked. No massage therapy, no chiropractor, and he specifically says no drugs worked. So I'm guessing that was weed, that was painkillers. He's like, literally nothing works. So maybe his muted way of speaking had more to do with the fact that he was probably in horrible, terrible fucking pain, at least for the scenes that he had to sit down in, which, good on him. He's a fucking trooper, but Jesus Christ. It's weird that it took, you know, apparently Lucas flew out, you know, because he was flying back and forth between the production and California, and it took him flying out and basically saying, you know what? No, shut it down. Let's have Harrison go get his surgery and we'll deal with that later. You know, the movie's not important enough for this man to be completely and actively hobbled.
Yeah. So do you want to get into the two tertiary characters, or the two side characters?
I'd like to
go out on a limb and say that I'm too old to be complaining too much about Willie Scott. So as far as Willie Scott goes, I'm too old to sort of fall into the trap of sort of being a mark for the way the movie wants you to think of her. Because the movie wants you to hate her. You mentioned before in the chat that if like the movie's aim was for you to miss Marion Ravenwood, job well done. But think of the character having to fill the role of C-3PO, of the love interest, and kind of the audience surrogate. If I wasn't in the situations that she was in, I'd probably be reacting in a similar way. But they also want you to kind of dislike her because of how shallow she comes off, how sort of much she comes, how sort of many stereotypes of female characters, such as like she almost seems like a gold digger. She seems weak-willed in the face of Indiana Jones. Like it's not very good writing. We should mention that this is one of the two pillars of George Lucas having recently gotten a divorce.
Yeah.
The writing of this movie. But I just like, it is what it is. It's fine. The character's okay. Like, I can't be annoyed by a character who the movie wants me to be annoyed so much by.
No, I have a high tolerance for annoying characters I've discovered over the years. And she does not annoy me as much as the movie is hoping I am annoyed by her.
Right.
But yeah, she does come off as unlikable in a lot of situations where I'm trying to say this in a way that's not offensive, but it's a bitch shut up moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what the movie is hoping that the audience says. So the movie doesn't have to say it.
But really, it's just the script just tries way too hard for that. And ultimately, that's what you get mad at when you're in your 30s.
Yeah. I mean, it's... I think as the movie goes on, and as I kind of got a little further away from the movie after watching it for a couple days later, I was like, you know what? As a character, she's fine. She's not nearly as annoying as, again, the movie wants to make her out to be. Because... yeah, like her life gets turned upside fucking down in the course of one fucking evening, basically. So why wouldn't you be a panic wreck? If all of a sudden Indiana Jones came to my fucking workplace and the next thing I know I'm in fucking India with, you know, some white dude and his weird child servant, I'd be freaking the fuck out. I think anybody else would be.
I think we need to talk about Short Round now. So, again, I don't have a problem with Short Round as a character. He's fine. On the level of child actors, he is in the acceptable range. And he has a fun dynamic with Indy. He has good chemistry with Harrison Ford. They play off each other kind of well. I don't like the implication of this because it's stated explicitly in the camping scene that Indy met him when Short Round tried to pick his pocket. So he purchased him as a servant.
Is it that he purchased? I thought it was that Short Round was basically an orphan who tried to pick his pocket and then.
Well, I think the idea is he gave him money to work for him, and that's what he meant. But they use the word I bought him.
Say all you want about Batman and Robin, but like there doesn't appear to be like at least they're friends.
Yeah, I mean that whole a big part of that camping scene was apparently improvised between Harrison and Juan, just riffing while Willie screams Bloody Murphy. Ah, Jesus Christ. was I about to say Buddy Murphy? I think I was about to say Buddy Murphy.
What is this movie doing to us?
It's making me think of the Forgotten Sons for some reason. But yeah, that scene where Willie is screaming bloody murder and Indy and Short Round are going back and forth over which one of them cheated, which I thought was like, that was the scene that was like, okay, I'm cool with this kid. Certainly not a bad actor. And he's the good kind of precocious. Like if George Lucas had managed to find a kid like this for The Phantom Menace, I think people would have much better impressions of young Anakin, but it would have also taken a better director to get that performance out of an actor and just more chemistry in general with the actors on set. But yeah, they're fine. It's just in a movie full of weird racial shit, like a white man purchasing a young Asian boy. It's not a good look. It's just not a good look at all.
Right.
Is it weird that this movie isn't as racist as I thought it was going to be, but also is way more racist than I thought it was going to be at the same time? Like, it's the racism in this movie exists like kind of like in its own weird dimension, like Indy showing up in an Indian village and literally becoming a white savior the second he's laid eyes on is so like bizarre and kind of off-putting. And I don't know if that's just because of, like, I'm a person of color or I'm being overly sensitive or what, but it's
there. Nevertheless, yeah. I having never seen a single episode of Game of Thrones, like I've still seen the widely circulated image of very pale white Emilia Clarke. There she is again, crowd surfing among like a lot of like dark skin arms. And yeah. it's just the imagery is like we'll immediately bring to mind like that kind of thing.
Part of the reason that Hike and Katz were hired was because they had apparently traveled to India before. But, like, this has nothing to do with fucking... India is kind of, like... has so little to actually do with the movie that them being hired because this white couple once went there makes, like, no fucking sense at all. Like...
I've been to South India myself, and I would never, like, unless I did extensive research, maybe co-wrote it with someone who grew up there. Like, I would never deign to think that I had the ability to write about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why Kasdan didn't want to come back to this movie, and that I think he'll, given his body of work, I think he realized that, like, he was going to be completely out of his depth writing the kind of stuff that Lucas wanted him to write in this movie, because it gets weirder. It gets weirder. It gets weirder than Indy and a small Asian boy and a lounge singer on elephants riding through the jungle.
And let's also talk about, like, how bombastic the opening is. Like, aside from, like, the sort of goofily comedic stuff, you have the sort of raft from the plane, like, landing in the water, like, them falling off the waterfall, like, in a very cartoon kind of style. We can compare it to Raiders of the Lost Ark, where obviously Indy gets into a lot of hijinks, but it all seems more or less grounded. Everything that, like, the way he finds himself out of predicaments in Raiders seems much grittier. Like, the way he gets out of the Well of Souls, the just simply running away from a boulder. Like you said before, you get a good idea of his character. And in this case, it just seems like the most outlandish hijinks in comparison.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about the first act of Raiders of the Lost Ark perfectly set up basically everything you needed to know about what was going to happen, whereas the first act of this movie explains basically jack shit about what happens in the rest of it. Because it gets weird, and this was a movie where it could have used a lot more exposition about what was going to happen and why it was happening and all that good stuff, and we just kind of get thrown in are like, just take this at face value.
Right.
Well, I mean, even Raiders had the scene at the opening, not really relating to anything other than introducing Belloc. But even then, like, immediately after, you get a big exposition dump.
Yeah, it just felt like we never got that scene of, like, I mean, they kind of explain what the stones are, but it's not made clear. I mean, the stones aren't even
and they give all the exposition to a guy who doesn't speak English.
Yeah, it was literally Spielberg saying something in English and then the actor repeating what it was that he said. So that guy didn't even know, that actor didn't even know much English to begin with.
Yeah.
There's just so many weird choices in this movie. And I wonder if it does kind of smack of Spielberg didn't tell Lucas no enough. I don't know. Because the second act of this movie is where I get, like, really weirded out. The first act of this movie it's not terrible. And in comparison to the rest of the movie, that's why it seems normal. Yes, the movie opening with the fucking music number makes no fucking sense in the context of this universe, but the next two acts of this, or at least the second act of this movie, is, oh boy,
it's all weird all the time.
It is nothing but pure 100% weirdness, and also a lot more kind of foolishly racist stuff. Do we just want to go and talk about the second act now? Because I feel like that's where most of the discussion is going to come from.
Let's do it.
Alrighty. Here we go with act two.
Okay. On the way to Pankot Palace, Indy finds a couple of ominous statues, including one with severed fingers strung around it. Make their way to Pankot and are welcomed by Chatterlal, the Prime Minister to His Highness the young Maharaja Zalim Singh. At the opulent banquet, complete with dancers and saris and a band, they are also introduced to the British Indian Army Captain Philip Blumbert, one of the most iconic characters in this movie, nay, this franchise, nay, film history. Willie Scott comes on the scene in a sari of her own, with designs to marry into the Maharaja's riches. We are presented with our meal consisting of a dead but very pregnant snake, some fat scarabs, eyeball soup, and chilled monkey brains. Be amused at Willie's unsubtle horror once again, audience. Indy sleepily confronts Chatter about rumors that Pankot was known for being the stamping ground of thuggy cultists. Harrison Ford at this point is speaking in negative decibels. Chatter and the Maharaja assure everyone that such things are no longer practiced. After dinner, Indy and Willie have an argument of, you want to sleep with me? No, you want to sleep with me. Before they are able to meet in the middle, an assassin tries to murder Jones and gets hanged by way of ceiling fan. Willie is beside herself that he is more interested in groping a statue of Shiva. Indy's indiscretion results in a secret passage. Short Round and Jones make their way through a sort of facsimile of Raiders' opening scene. They allow the audience to be scared by bloated and decayed corpses along with a bed of various insects, to which Short Round makes a racist and inaccurate comparison. They soon find themselves in a descending ceiling room, and Willie, having been delayed in following them, must rescue them despite her being scared by things such as the bugs and an apparent Minok on the cave wall. She finally pushes back upon the impression and the trap stops. The three come upon the thuggies worshipping at the statue of Kali. The Maharaja is in black garb and Chatterlal is in their ranks. Our big bad, Mola Ram, places the Sankara stones in the eyes and nose of a skull statue with a cobra statue above it. In a scene most reflective of George Lucas's divorce, Mola is able to open a captive's chest cavity and pull out his heart, which is soon set ablaze. The captive is lowered into a swirling pit of hell, apparently. Indy attempts to retrieve the stones from the statue, but he, Willie, and Short Round are discovered. In the midst of horrible visuals of enslaved children from the village, we see a captive Indy argue with Mola about the merits of the whole thuggy operation. In their discussion, we have a brief mention of British colonization, but that's brushed aside because the white dude has to be intellectually right in the face of a person of color enslaving him and others. Mola assures Indy that he will soon be one of them and worship Kali, who is completely, totally an evil god. The villain wants to eradicate every religion on the planet. Short Round and Indy get whipped. Indy is taken away and forced to drink some kind of potion. He grins, possessed. And that's Act 2.
Like I said, all weird, all the time.
That doesn't even get to some of the weirdness, like...
We could talk about it. I just, like, again, I wrote before that there was a bit of a haze recalling this stuff. So I tried to keep it to the most operative things. But yeah, remember, guys, like, white people can also be slaves and whips.
Oh, god damn it.
That's kind of what yeah.
This. So if you want to know, if you really want to know what peak white people is, it's everybody, Spielberg and the writers and the producers, all being like, oh yeah, well, you know, the dinner scene, it was obviously so tongue-in-cheek, and, you know, it was just there, you know, Steven really likes practical jokes, and he just was trying to be funny, and it's just glossed over that they present the Indian people as snake and bug-eating, backwards, like... just backwards people. And I think it is very easy for a white person to be like, oh, well, clearly I didn't mean any racist intent by it, therefore it is not racist. But honestly, that scene is racist as fuck, because people are going to walk away from this movie, and if they don't know any Indian people, they're just gonna assume what they saw in the movie was right. And it doesn't matter if the movie takes place in the 1930s, they're going to assume that that happens, like, now. So it's just really irresponsible, especially for Spielberg, who I would think, given his history of handling race issues pretty delicately, that he would have looked at the script and said, okay, maybe the scene shouldn't be in there. But he didn't, and the movie is kind of, sort of, worse off for that.
I think the most generous thing you could say about it is that it's ignorant and inaccurate. And, like, nobody necessarily did anything about it. Like, nobody did any research. I believe that they cut out a scene where Indiana Jones is like, there's no way that these guys are genuine, like, Hindu, because they would never eat meat. And leaving aside that itself is inaccurate, like, and a bit too broad.
Yeah.
Like, you wonder why they left it out. But again, like, it needs to be said, like, they don't eat beef. They generally don't eat pork, but they will eat chicken. They will eat, like, they're not, it's not all vegetarian. So it's, again, like, just broad inaccuracies.
Yeah, it's not even that everyone who practices, you know, Hinduism doesn't eat beef. Like, it's a broad church, to say the very least. And this movie does kind of a disservice to that, and it's super uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Like, it just is, you can't get around this movie without that. And Roshan Seth, who actually played Gandhi in the 1980s Gandhi movie, which was really critically acclaimed, he kind of said that he also kind of errs on the fact that, oh, well, of course, this isn't meant to be racist, and it's kind of silly. But, like, if I mentioned before that the Indian government just requested a bunch of changes, and in the behind the scenes documentary, it is presented as though those demands were completely unreasonable. But when you see how the Indian people are presented in this movie, especially, you know, we talk about Hinduism, but, like, whatever the thuggy cult in this movie believe, it has, like, no tie whatsoever to whatever Indian religion or Middle Eastern religion or anything else you want to think of. It is just, like, a grab bag of tropes from other fucking cultures, basically. Ritual sacrifice.
Pardon my correction, but Ben Kingsley was Gandhi. Roshan Seth was a different character. He was Dalsim in the Street Fighter movie.
Sorry.
And therefore, highly acclaimed movie.
Yeah. Oh, well, then that Bing's Ben Kingsley, then he's not even Indian. Okay, you know what? We'll...
Oh, this is just a mess. Like, I'm scared to even say anything about this, because, like, I don't have... I feel like I shouldn't even be saying anything about this. I mean, because I don't know actually, the correct way it should be depicted.
Ben Kingsley is, his father is Gujarati.
Okay.
So there's at least, like, some amount of that. He's biracial. But,
I mean, backlash, I get where you're coming from, because, but the fact that you don't know what to say and that you probably wouldn't have written this movie in this way is a good thing. Like, yeah. Because you acknowledge that you don't know enough about it to form, like, an opinion about it. Or not to form an opinion about it, but to know what is the right way this culture is portrayed and what is the wrong way this culture is portrayed.
I disclaim, like, everything I say about this with, like, my very, very wide gap lack of authority. But, like, benefit of 2021, benefit of Wikipedia being in front of me, the two gods that they talk about, the two Hindu gods they talk about are Shiva and Kali. As far as I can tell, they pretty much render Kali as, like, an evil god.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of use that this is a thuggy cult, but as an excuse, but they don't sort of go out of their way to say that they sort of perverse notion of Hinduism. They seem to render Kali as a definitely evil god in this movie, which is not the case.
Yeah.
She's one god of many in Hinduism.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. But again, like, I won't say anymore because...
Yeah, I mean, even I am not an authority on it. All I know is that my wife's best friend is Indian, and that one of my groomsmen is Indian, and I've gotten, you know, not a vast knowledge, but at least enough of a knowledge that if I was sitting down to write a movie, I would Google it. Or if it's the 1980s, go read a fucking encyclopedia. Or, I don't know, hire a person of color to fix the script or something. Just, It's just uncomfortable. And you mentioned Molo Ram. I didn't even know what Molo Ram's name was, because they don't even say what his name is, I think, until that scene where I don't even think that Indy says his name when he's getting tortured by him. I think it's not until the bridge scene that we know what his name is.
Right. They say it once or twice. Like, if you're watching the movie with subtitles, then they'll indicate it enough that you figure it out. But that's about it.
Yeah, it just there's a lot of weird, just weird, bizarre shit. I think the best thing about this movie is that the Maharaja reminded me of Jinder Mahal and kind of made me reconsider whether Jinder Mahal's title reign. Jinder Mahal.
I was trying to call back to our old dark match bit.
We have a bit about Jinder?
We never knew who the fuck he was.
I recorded like 95 episodes of that podcast, and a lot of it is repressed memory.
I remember
a few, and like any time someone would say his name, we'd just go, who?
Imagine our surprise.
I thought that was Gunner's pal. What's Gunner's pal?
No, that was in universe though. This I'm talking specifically on our show.
I don't know. I don't remember that, which speaks greatly to Jinder Mahal's rapid ascent to main event status and rapid descent from main event status. But you know, enough wrestling until I read my act summary.
Oh, nice. We could talk about Mortal Kombat though. Among the many influences on that original video game.
Yeah, I mean, there's
someone's heart getting ripped out.
Yeah, but again, it's just weird. Like in Raiders of the Lost Ark, it was presented that Indy didn't necessarily believe in God or anything like that. He was just like an archaeologist that wanted to find these artifacts for purely historical reasons. And in
don't they kind of try to go for that? Like there's a few scenes where it's like, oh, it's just a bunch of religious mumbo jumbo. But then by the end of the movie, you betrayed Shiva. And I don't know how we got there.
This whole second act is just weird.
Yeah.
This whole second.
My wife, I miss her so much. The way she treated me. Like someone, it's like an evil cult leader ripped my heart out and then lowered me into a swirling pit of hell.
Oh, man. Maybe the reason his wife divorced him is because she saw the script for this movie and was like, George, God damn it. I just can't do this anymore. Or maybe it's because she didn't get enough credit for saving his first hit, which, you know. Or whatever. Again, we're not a gossip show.
Marsha.
I mean, there was good. I did like the kind of interplay. I mean, I think it came right the fuck out of nowhere, because until the scene where it happens, Indy and Willie just seem completely and utterly at each other's throat, and then all of a sudden the second act happens and they want to go to bed together. And it doesn't, like, make it. I like the actors because the actors have a chemistry. And I feel like Kate Capshaw apparently got a lot of shit for her role in this movie. And I don't think it's earned, because I think she does really good with the material that she's given. Like, I don't think she's a good actress. Like,
it's audiences being a mark, because I like the scene where they're sort of like competing with each other, but ultimately what the movie wants to make us believe is that she's too weak-willed to sort of like allow him to sort of crawl to her.
Right. So I think that's fine. I think the scene in itself is fine, even if I feel like there's no setup for it. Mm. And I do like the spiked floor and crushing ceiling scene, but again, to bring up Star Wars again, is that not just a trash compactor scene? Like, Spielberg and Lucas have a lot of the same influences, And in instances like that, you can totally see that their minds are in the exact same place. But given that Lucas was so involved with the story, you would think, like, if Kazan wrote this movie, I'm sure he would have been like, George, you already did this spot. Like, damn it, D'Lo, we already did this spot in Star Wars A New Hope. Like, but I guess they were just like, oh, well, no one's going to remember. And it's not, you know, they're not getting crushed from the sides. They're getting crushed from the top and the bottom. It's just, and I feel like I'm burying the scene, but it's a good scene and it's funny. And I like the interplay between all the, like all the stuff with Indy and Willie and Short Round, I'm a big fan of, because I think they all have a really good chemistry with each other. Mm-hmm. I just think it's surrounded with a lot of ancillary bullshit that you, at least with 2021 eyes, you can't not see it for what it is.
Yeah, exactly. And again, comparing the scene where Short Round and Indy are sort of going through that secret passage in the caverns, kind of Raiders influenced, where they avoid traps and there are a bunch of like creepy crawlies. This allows me to talk about the terrible line of Short Round comparing like stepping on bugs to fortune cookies. To have a Vietnamese actor play a Chinese native character who talks about an Asian American invention. I don't even think it was actually on a minute. Just scan Wikipedia.
Why does this movie have to make me think things? Like, yeah. Raiders of the Lost Ark, we talked about it at... What we could talk about was that it was simple. And that, yes, there were a couple cringy things. Yes, there were instances of brown face where they really shouldn't have been. But, like, the movie itself, it... If nothing else, it treats the environments that they're in as with respect. You know, they go to Egypt and Egypt is treated with respect. The culture is treated with respect. You know, we don't see the pyramids. We see the dig site and we see hardworking men, and the Nazis are presented as assholes who demand that the brown skinned people get them water. Like, that country and that culture is presented so well. And then you get to this movie and like anybody with any hint of color is just like presented in a not great way.
And they're either sort of victims of exploitation for the sake of making the other brown people who are villains seem much worse.
Mm-hmm.
To sort of scrap, I had another comparison, but suffice it to say, like, when Mola and Indy are having their sort of like hero villain sort of like disagreement, you hear British colonization mentioned for just like a quick second and then like completely brushed aside, because the villain then is like, he's so evil, he wants to get rid of the all the faithful Hindus, then he wants to get rid of the Muslims, then he wants to get rid of the Christians and Hebrews.
This is not a movie about British colonization. It is about big evil man who rips hearts out, stealing children from this lovely little village. That's as complex as they want to make it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this story in this script has Lucas's fingerprints all over it. And it
makes excuses to avoid discourse.
Yeah. And again, Spielberg says that this is his least favorite of these three movies, and I can see what he even said, that a lot of the stuff, you know, for Raiders, he had tons of storyboards. They storyboarded basically that entire movie, and there's bits and bobs that they come up with on set, but he storyboarded literally like almost every single shot in that movie. And in this movie, he's like, yeah, well, you know, for this movie, he actually says in the behind the scenes, he's like, I didn't have a great sense of the movie, and therefore it was a lot harder for me to kind of storyboard and we had to kind of make up what shots were going to look like and what blocking and stuff was going to look like on the set. And it's weird to me that he was so out of touch with this basic story that he couldn't find ways to envision what was happening. And we're talking, this is a director who is very granular on the details and in how stuff works. You know, he's a visionary in how movies are made and how they're shot. And he didn't have a lot of ideas for how to communicate this story. It's very, very telling. And we bury George Lucas a lot on this podcast, and we probably will bury him more even when we get to our next series and the series after that, for whatever reason. But
George Lucas is our go-to whipping boy.
Yeah, it'd be great if we could find another one.
That's what we get for starting with Star Wars.
But yeah, it's just, I mean, I have a lot to say about this act, which is weird because it's so much of this act is just bizarre nonsense that makes no fucking sense. Like, nothing's explained. We don't know why there's a random tomb. We don't know why that specific tomb leads to a fucking underground pit of scum and villainy, and we don't know what the ritual that they're doing is even supposed to do. Like,
why are the Shankara stones important?
Yeah.
Yeah, what does it give to them? Like, what power does it give to them?
There's 5 stones, so they're missing 3. So they're missing 2. So what does having the 3 stones even do?
What would having the 5 stones even do?
Apparently,
you transform into Supersonic or something?
No, he turns into Captain Planet. With your powers combined, he is Captain Kali. I wish, again, the first act of Indiana Jones does such a great job, or of Raiders of the Lost Ark, does such a great job of explaining exactly what everything is. And there's a couple things they don't mention, but it still feels like everything is explained. This is just presented as is, and you just have to deal with it as is. And Lucas and everybody in the cast talks a lot about how the problem with this movie was that, you know, it was dark, and the reason that critics and people maybe didn't like it is because it was too dark. And maybe that's why critics didn't like it at the time, but I think more than it being dark, because I don't think it's it's dark because it's kind of fucking racist and plays fast and loose with other people's cultures, but that's not what critics are talking about. I don't think it's dark. I just think it doesn't make a lot of sense, and it wouldn't have been dark if they had just explained what the fuck was going on. Do we want to move on to Act 3 now?
Yep.
Okay.
All right. Now, Act 3. So, we're back in the magical cave of bullshit that wasn't explained to us. Only this time with a shirtless Indiana Jones and Chitara standing in front of the chanting masses as Mola prepares to sacrifice Willy. For reasons that I can't explain because the movie hasn't explained any of this, Willy gets strapped into the weird sacrificial lowering thingy. We think that Mola is going to pull out Lee's heart, but he doesn't, which begs the question, is the heart thing something Mola just does for fun? Or does he not do it here because the screenwriters couldn't figure out a way to get the heart back into Willy? Whatevs. Willy pleads to Indy to snap out of it, but he just handcuffs her. Willy spits in Indy's face like Randy Orton to Mick Foley, but Indy just laughs. Short Round manages to escape capture by breaking his chains. We get lots of reaction shots of Willy screaming and Indy looking nonplussed. A short round evades capture and enters the titular Temple of Death. Doom. He tries to get Indy to snap out of it, but gets backhanded for it. Willie is basically at the same level of the pit that the first sacrifice was at, but unlike him, she doesn't burst into flames because plot. Short Round grabs a torch and tells Indy he loves him, before nearly setting him on fire. For some reason that is actually explained in a deleted scene, being touched by the fire snaps Indy out of it. He tries to play like he's still in the midst of a spell for all of 2 seconds before he starts dealing out punches and flinging guys into the open pit of lava in the temple. Indy tries to get to Mola, but he disappears via a convenient floor slide because it's not time for him to die yet. Indy attempts to save Willie, who, again, should be cooked to a delicious brown crisp, but isn't because shrug. Indy grabs a hold of the crank mechanism and then tries to pull her up, but Chitara Lal tries to stab Indy like he was Sid Vicious and Indy was Arn Anderson. The murder of Indy is averted with an assist from Short Round, and Chitara is kind of sort of not really crushed by the crank and disappears from the movie. Indy rescues Willie and gets smacked in the face for his efforts, but then they kiss and make up. Indy also apologizes to Short Round before he decides that it's time to play a literal actual white savior by freeing all the kids in the prison camp. Indy, Willie, and Short Round are able to take out most of the guards and free all of the children before Indy has to go face to face with the biggest, meanest, thuggy guard in the room. Short Round attempts to help and damn near gets chokeslammed as Indy manages to find his way onto a slow-moving conveyor belt. Indy starts to get the upper hand, but is stopped by the Maharaja, because voodoo dolls are totally a part of Indian religion. Short Round has to solve the platforming puzzle to make it up to Jinder Mahal and is able to nearly light him on fire as well, snapping the kid out of it. Through some poorly dubbed dialogue, he tells Short Round that they need to take the left tunnel. Spoiler warning, they don't take the left tunnel. Indy is able to beat the guard just in time for the guy to get his outfit caught in the conveyor belt and end up as a red smear. Indy, Willie, and Short Round escape into a minecart section that would go on to inform literally every single minecart section you've ever played in a video game, and most of the minecart-themed roller coasters you've ridden. Guards chase after them. Lots of yelling happens while Mola stands around being useless. More stuff happens, and eventually the bad guys meet their doom. Indy climbs out of the cart and stops it with his shoes. Our heroes barely have time to celebrate before water starts rushing towards them. They find a conveniently placed ledge to avoid the water. Short Round and Willie try to cross a bridge while Indy does a callback and battles some more mooks, but Willie and Short Round are once again captured by Mola, who looks way less intimidating in the bright sunlight. Guards go after Indy on the bridge, and Mola forces Willie and Short Round back onto the bridge as well, when Indy threatens to cut the ropes. Unfortunately, Mola does not realize that Indy is an insane person, and he cuts the ropes anyway, sending the moops crashing into the water with hungry, ravenous crocodiles. Mola and Indy briefly tussle for the bag containing the 3 stones of Chakra, but Indy wins by repeatedly chanting at Mola and Indy over his disgrace of the god Shiva or whatever, until the bag bursts into flames and 2 of the 3 stones drop. Mola briefly catches the 3rd one, but it scalds his hands and makes him drop, with Indy able to catch it. Indy gets shot at by natives with bows and arrows, who are then chased off by the Indian army with a Britain command because 1935. The day is saved and Indy is able to return to the village with the rock. Indy and Willie briefly pretend they don't want to bang each other before giving into temptation, the film ending on a kiss, and with a celebration of all the kids Indy freed surrounding him. Roll the credits, and we're out. So, it's way more interesting to explain, or way easier to explain Indiana Jones, how he acts in this 3rd act, when you realize that, yeah, Harrison Ford was probably on painkillers at the time.
Yeah, it felt like his entire performance was riding on that moment of him being sorry, backlash.
No, it's fine. I'm just going to say, if nothing else, at least the 3rd act is exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, stuff happens.
Minecart.
Yeah, the minecart happens.
Resident Evil 4, baby. anything else with the minecart.
Did Resident Evil 4 just steal everything from Indiana Jones?
Yes.
It stole everything from everything, including games that were originally supposed to be Resident Evil 4 and later became Devil May Cry.
But, yeah, I just... we don't know why the Shikara Stones are important, so it makes it really weird that Indy is able to start yelling at Mola in fluent Hindi, which apparently makes the stones heat up and burst into flames, but how could Indy know that? Like,
well, yeah, it's weird. We were talking about how he wrote that shit off as mumbo jumbo before, but now he's such a talented archaeologist and anthropologist that like he knows what to do in this situation. He's heard so much about it. He's memorized the verses.
It just, again, just some I'm not asking for a whole lot. I just want some explanation of why this shit is happening, because they're not explaining it is not working for me at all. It's just fucking bizarre. Like this.
Yeah.
It's just it doesn't make any sense. Like, and it doesn't make any sense. The scenes that were cut out of this movie, like there is a deleted scene in this movie wherein Short Round sees a guard catch on fire and the guard is briefly freed from the spell of the, I don't even know what it's called, the fucking black water mist. All that fucking water reminds me of is Dragon Ball Z and the Garlic Jr. saga. A saga so important to Dragon Ball Z that Dragon Ball Z Abridged didn't even want to cover it. But yeah, there was that deleted scene, and that was an important scene that had to be in the movie. Like, I think you mentioned that there was actually a line of dialogue that said that someone said that these thuggy people, they must not actually be of the religion, but they can't be because they eat meat, which is, again, wrong. But besides that, I think that was a deleted scene, too. Like, I don't remember hearing that dialogue in the movie.
No,
I remember,
it definitely was. It was a deleted scene.
Yeah. So these are two opportunities for them to explain shit, and they just choose not to. And it's not even like the film was running long or that it like stopped the flow of the scene. Like, those are little incidental things that would not have harmed the movie at all, but would have explained what the fuck is going on.
The way I approach these movies, I try to put my mind into the person who was writing and directing. And when you're talking about George Lucas, that's a big ask. I guess they were just more interested in like action, getting from one scene to the next. It has to be exciting.
I mean, there is a lot of influence in these movies of, you know, the old serial films. And I think there's a degree of, well, those serials, they didn't explain a lot of what happened in the movie, so we don't have to really explain a lot of what happened in our movie either. But that's not the way movies in the 80s worked.
Yeah, I've got, and so yeah, like, I think we're going in this direction, but is that an 80s thing that people just didn't care back then? And now we, in the 21st century, under the influence of CinemaSins, now want an explanation to every little thing.
I don't think it is, because look at Spielberg's other, I mean, he was, before this movie, he filmed E.T., and, like, it's not that we know a lot of, we don't know what planet E.T. comes from, or shit like that. But the movie does a good job of explaining kind of like what E.T.'s power set is and how E.T. communicates and like what the plot of the actual movie is. What's the problem in this movie that you know, Charlie is Charlie in E.T., right?
I don't know. It's been so long since I've seen E.T.
Yeah, I should watch that movie again. But like, it presents what the problem for the child in this extraterrestrial is and how they need to solve this problem. E.T. phone home. E.T. wants to go home. Like, you don't need a whole fucking lot. So I don't think it's a thing of we're looking at this 1980s movie with 2020 eyes and our jaded sense of knowing how movies are written and constructed is coloring our views. I think it's just, this was just laziness on the part of the screenwriters that wasn't corrected by anyone. And everyone just kind of went along with it because it was what George wanted.
I probably have to agree with you because I've said before, Back to the Future is my favorite series of movies. And it's a movie about time travel. And on a scale of time travel bullshit, it's pretty high up there. But you understand the plot. Like, first movie is, oh, I accidentally prevented my parents from meeting. I have to fix this or otherwise I won't exist. Second movie, oh, bad guy got a book from the future and now he's a rich asshole. I've got to stop him. Third movie, oh, I'm back in Western times. What the fuck? But you understand.
Third movie is a little harder.
Yeah. All the movies, you understand the plot. And it doesn't stand up to scrutiny if you think about it. Like, again, just Google the grandfather paradox. But still, doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter because they explain just enough for you to be able to latch on and be like, okay, this is the thing that is happening now. Like, that's all I'm asking for in this movie is just for the movie to stop for 5 fucking seconds and be like, okay, this is what is happening. This is why it's happening. And now back to our action bullshit. Yeah,
and ultimately, I think that the problems we're having, like, aside from the some of the things that we're speaking about in terms of inaccuracy of cultural references are things that we have the benefit of being at our fingertips without necessarily needing to have a book on Hinduism or that aspect of Indian culture. But for the most part, we're speaking about very foundational things. Like, these are not like complete nitpicks that we're going through. They're things that are inconsistent with the level of the world that the previous movie introduced, and things that are again foundational with the movie itself, with the Temple of Doom.
Yeah, it's like this movie existing in the same universe as the first movie is just bizarre. The decision to make it a prequel to the first movie while not moving Indy forward as a character is bizarre. And it's something that kind of gets rectified in The Last Crusade. But I don't know, man. Like, this, I think Spielberg makes a lot of great movies, and this one feels like a fucking whiff, and this third act feels like a fucking whiff because it doesn't. What about it makes sense? Again, I like the interplay between Indy, Willie, and Short Round. Like, all the incidental stuff with them is fine, and I think it kind of saves this from being like super bad. I mean, and I don't even think the movie is bad because, again, the more distance I get away from it, the more I'm like, you know what, that movie wasn't awful. Like, I don't feel like this was a waste of time of watching. Like, there's good aspects of it, but the story and the plot are just all over the fucking place. Like, and the stuff that they cut out of this movie is all. It makes no sense because the only thing I can see is that it would have explained shit. Like, there's even was supposed to be a scene where Willie, after she's captured, Willie manages to escape, which would have shown that Willie had, you know, some fight and some ability to fend for herself. She would have escaped and she would have run back into Chatar Lal. And that's when we would have realized that he too is a part of this evil thuggy cult. Like when Chatar Lal winds up showing up in the Temple of Doom next to Indy, it makes no sense because he's gone from the movie for like 20 minutes at that point, and then he's just there, even though he wasn't there for the first sacrifice. It's little shit like that. And they filmed that scene. They filmed that scene and just decided that they didn't want to put it in the movie for whatever reason. And all it would have done was explain just a little bit more of the story. Just give us a little bit more to say, okay, well, that makes sense. It makes sense why he's there. It makes sense why Short Round tries to burn Indy. It makes sense why they want these stones. It makes sense why they're eating, you know, snakes and bugs. It's not because they're actually part of the thuggy religion. It's because they're part of this weird sect that's not even... All the kind of weird shit we talk about Hinduism in this movie would have been fine if someone was like, yo, like this whatever they're doing, it is not part of the thuggy religion. This is a perversion of Hinduism. This is not what they actually believe. Instead, it just presents everything as is. And we talked in the last movie about how there wasn't a lot of subtext and everything was kind of text, and we liked that in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Here's an example of everything being text and it being a really not good thing.
Dear movie, please make sense. Sign the Sequelize It podcast.
Yeah. Funny thing is that from what I understand, like thuggies were just like bandits and murderers. Like as far as I know, there's no like religious aspect to it. They're just like people who would rip others off and people who would kill others for whatever reason that may be.
Again, I know that the writers didn't exist in a time of Wikipedia, and I know that they went to India on vacation or whatever, but like, fucking read a book. Like, come on. Like, this is so fucking lazy. And then, I mean, there is cool, again, there's cool shit. We can talk about the weird callback can't really be a callback because it happens in the future. Like, where Indy meets up with two mooks and they, like, twirl their swords around, and then Indy reaches for his gun and realizes he doesn't have his gun, so he has to fight them barehanded. Like, on the one hand, yeah, that's kind of funny, but on the second hand, I guess this is a nitpick, but it makes no sense given that he doesn't have the experience of what happened in Raiders, so why the fuck is he doing this in this movie? Yeah,
it's a bit of a time paradox. He acts like he should. The same situation should occur in Raiders. Like, he acts like it's a familiar situation that isn't to his advantage this time.
Yeah, which I think the reason why Lucas wanted this to be set in 1935 is because he wanted to separate it from Raiders, because he didn't want Indy to have to fight Nazis again. To which I say, what's the problem with setting this movie in 1937 and Indy doesn't have to fight Nazis because he's in fucking India? So what do the Nazis have to do with this movie that this movie had to be a prequel? Inventing a problem to justify a stupid idea.
Yeah.
Like, I...
So I really don't know what else I can say about this third act. I mean, because the action really isn't the sort of point. It's stuff that's fun in retrospect and fun while you're watching, but it's not really things that we can talk up, like, due to the other issues of the movie. Like, the idea of having, like, a suspension rope bridge, like is pretty tense, but it would have been better served in a movie with a more fulfilling plot.
Yeah, and like the end, like apparently there was there were British engineers in India at the time, and they basically asked them to rig this bridge, and the bridge, in order to split in the perfect way that it did, is rigged with explosives, and they made, you know, they put a lot of dummies on the bridge that kicked, you know, that automatically kicked as they fell, and it's like that is the level of craftsmanship that I expect from a Steven Spielberg movie. And it's weird that like none of that craftsmanship seems to make it into other aspects of the movie. And so I guess we can just move on to our final thoughts then.
Yeah.
It was ultimately a disappointment compared to the last movie, which, as you called it, was the perfect popcorn movie that we were often at a loss to praise, because, like, how often can you just say, this scene really works? It's very exciting. As much excitement as there was in the previous film, there's quite a bit of bafflement in this one. Yeah, it'll always be like the sort of odd one out, and of course we're speaking of this in terms of a trilogy, like without even like there's no need to talk about Crystal Skull. We'll get to how weird that movie is, but not weird like this one. Like just bah.
Yeah, on that subject, I'm probably gonna have, if we end up ranking these like Star Wars, I'm probably gonna have to have a good think about my ranking on these. But ultimately, I can't say I hate this movie.
Yeah.
Because the plot is nonsensical and everything is racist and wrong. But, you know, it's at least exciting and fun. And that's what I want out of an Indiana Jones movie. So ultimately, like, it does its job, but I would only call it serviceable as compared to Raiders, which was exemplary.
Yeah, it's just watching this after watching Raiders is like a shock to the system, because that first movie feels so expertly crafted and edited and acted, and this movie is expertly acted, and that's about it. Like, there's so much stuff that doesn't make sense, and just as a person of color, there's so much really... I mean, I don't want to get into too much about like racism and stuff like that, because that is can be its whole different podcast. But like the thing I will say is that like people think that like racism is done in the overt stuff. Like people's idea of racism is like the Ku Klux Klan and calling black people the N-word and burning crosses. Like, that's the idea that people have of racism. Like, really racist shit is insidious. It's stuff like the stuff in this movie where the white people don't... The white people who make this movie aren't exactly intending to offend a culture. In some ways, they think they're paying a culture a tremendous amount of respect, and that they're showcasing other cultures and things about the cultures that they like, and then they could just throw this other shit in. You know, it was never meant to be this, but it, like, even if it's not meant to be it, taken as like the sum of its parts, you can't really ignore this. So do I think it's a bad movie? No. Do I think it's a enjoyable movie? Yeah, I like the interplay between our three leads. I think there's a lot of fun action. It's great to see, you know, again, I haven't seen these movies, so I finally got to see the minecart scene. I actually like the scene where, you know, they're standing on the side of the mountain with water spouting out, and that was just like, they just built a mountain and shot it like in England. Like, I like all that stuff is there, but there's just so much other stuff that I'm like, this is a swing and a miss. I think we alluded to the fact that Steven Spielberg doesn't really make bad movies. This might not be a bad movie, but it's an aggressively mediocre one. And on that bombshell, next week, hopefully, again, the great thing about this franchise is that it's like, yay, boo, yay, boo. Like, you kind of know where these movies kind of like stand. So next week, we'll be watching Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Well, hey, if that's a pattern, maybe the upcoming fifth Indiana Jones movie might actually be good.
Yeah, if they...
I mean, I'm not going to hold my breath, yeah, but...
We can talk about that more extensively in the fourth movie, but I have my thoughts about that.
Yeah. But, yeah, just... Have you guys seen The Last Crusade? Do you have kind of any initial thoughts on The Last Crusade?
Like the previous movie, aside from Raiders and Crystal Skull, funnily enough, I'd only seen pieces of The Last Crusade, but what I saw, I enjoyed.
Yeah, same here. I've only really seen the ending of it, so I'm kind of interested to, you know, see it in full.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. I've heard nothing but good things about this movie. Sean Connery comes back in this movie in a role that he actually gives a shit about. Which, you know, even early 90s, Sean Connery was kind of like, I just want to go back to my fucking island and chill. But apparently he gives a great performance in the next movie. And it's kind of cool that, you know, Steven Spielberg never got to direct his James Bond, but he got to work with James Bond.
Yeah.
And I kind of wonder if that movie is going to be like, what if James Bond had a kid? I get the feeling that's kind of the vibe we're going to get, but I guess we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. And so... Ay. This movie. Those are my final thoughts on this movie. And so, until next time, this has been KC.
I am your foxy friend Backlash, and I gotta go.
Oh God.
I'm no Crystal.
Is he gonna get crushed? Did we get him in trouble again? I feel like we got him in trouble again.
He has billions of dollars. Like, he could work out any problem, especially even...
Backlash has billions of dollars?
No, George Lucas has billions of dollars. He could do anything, even if it means putting a hit out on one of our co-hosts.
Huh.
And embezzling the funds in education, allegedly.
Wait.
I'm no Crystal Life.
And we'll see you next time on Sequelize It. Wait. What is this about embezzlement?
No. That I didn't make that up. That was...